This is the North Sound Energy Week podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Energy Week podcast. I'm Fiona Winchester. Another busy week full of debate over secret government documents, the windfall tax, holidays for offshore workers and EU regulation. On Monday, the First Minister visited both the city and shire on energy-related business. First off, he officially opened the new £6 million headquarters of Powerjax in Ellen. Over the last 20 years, the company has trained more than 50 apprentices in mechanical and machinery disciplines, from assembly to electrical. Mr. Salmon says he's proud the global company have decided to remain based in the northeast.
Well, opening up the new fantastic Powerjax facility here in Ellen, I mean, Powerjax has been around as long as I've been there. Was the MP for Banff and Buchan, and they found this wonderful new facility, moving out of their old bare premises in Fraserburgh, but into this great facility, taking all the workforce with them, and with great prospects for the next 25 years. This is a company now exporting to 60 different countries with 1,000 separate customers in skilled, specific engineering, high value-added products going right around the world, South America, Shanghai, the Middle East. You know, you name a country with an expanding marketplace, and Powerjax here in Ellen are supplying it with their gearing and their gearbox, facility parts and parts for remote vehicles under the ocean, parts for NASA and the space shuttle. They do everything, and they've got fantastic prospects to come. So it's great to see Scotland making things. It's great to see a company which is a successful Scottish engineering company, and it's fantastic to see a company with good prospects for the future. They made the point themselves that a lot of engineering companies in the past decided to go to low-cost locations, but they are in the very high end, the high quality end, the very specific end, bespoke products for key industries where people can't make mistakes. You know, if you put a remotely operated vehicle on the ocean floor, operating an oil facility, you can't make a mistake because the consequences are just too great, and therefore the quality is high cost of the products, but they're high quality because of the nature of what they're doing. So, you know, that's the area where Scotland is competing. But let's remember, Scottish engineering as a whole, as an industry, has been expanding its production and its exports over these last 18 months now, and they're making a great success in a range of markets. And of course, we've got big Scottish engineering markets at home now, in terms not just to the North Sea for the next 40 or 50 years, but the growing renewables sector again, something where Powerjax will be targeting. So they've got 60 countries that are exporting to internationally or more, and they've got the potential of a great engineering adventure at home. So there's a big market out there for high-quality products.
North Sound Energy Week.
That evening, the First Minister attended the launch of a potentially groundbreaking book for the oil and gas industry. Previously top-secret government papers are revealed in the official history of North Sea oil and gas. Aberdeen oil economist Professor Alec Kemp spent years delving into the last five decades of the industry. The book was commissioned by the Scottish Government and includes official records never released to the public. First Minister Alex Salmond says it's an interesting read.
Tell us a bit about this book and why you're supporting it.
Well, let's say a word about Alec Kemp first. I mean, we have in our midst, in the northeast of Scotland, the greatest international expert. We have in our... Let's say a word about Alec Kemp first. We have in our midst, in the northeast of Scotland, the greatest international expert on the planet on oil field taxation and finance. That person, Professor Alec Kemp, is now publishing the official history of North Sea oil and gas, looking over the last 40 years in infinite amount of detail, because he is the official historian. And that is a tremendous thing to acknowledge, you know, his work, his body of work. And to know that somebody with that knowledge and expertise is working in Aberdeen University. And it's time he got, and I'm sure he will now, get the recognition, the widespread public recognition, to have such a formidable body of expertise and work here in the northeast of Scotland.
And it's really, the book is groundbreaking. I mean, it's stuff that nobody's seen before, the government records.
Yeah, absolutely. He's gone for every government record, and although I'm quite certain there's bits he wasn't allowed to publish, what he is publishing is absolutely devastating. I mean, for example, the revelation, which we basically knew about from some government records, that how the North Sea oil resource was downplayed, deliberately downplayed, because they didn't want the Scots to get too uppity. So government ministers, way back in 1980, the energy minister, the Margaret Thatcher's energy minister in 1980, said that oil was in decline 31 years ago. I mean, and now we know it'll be here for the next 40 or 50 years. So that's a great interest. Secondly, I suspect things little historical aspects, like, you know, Alec details how the Shetland Islands, through the work of a very enterprising and clever clerk of the Shetland Islands Council, managed to secure the only direct benefit out with the Westminster government from oil and gas, much to the benefit of the islands, and how he had to force off or to fend off pressure from Westminster to be able to do that. But I suppose the revelation that Northern Ireland and Isle of Man got some direct benefit from Scottish oil, but Scotland didn't. Maybe one that make a lot of people sit up and take notice, because they got a share of Scottish royalties, and Scotland didn't get a share of our own royalties. So I think that has a great, not just historical resonance, but future resonance for the people of Scotland. And I think, thirdly, just this is a scholarly work, and the extensive nature of it does underline and stress the importance that this has been a huge adventure over these last 40 years. But perhaps the biggest bit of the adventure still to come, because although we may be slightly more than halfway through production, we're less than halfway through the value. There is more value of oil and gas to be extracted in the waters around Scotland than has been extracted over the last 40 years. And I think we can be absolutely certain of that. So there's a great amount of adventure still to come. And I'm sure that Alec Kemp's book will be used not just for historical reference, but as a foundational work for looking to that future.
Do you think that members of the UK government should be reading it, you know, for future policy decisions?
Well, members of the UK government have always tended to look upon oil for their own purposes. You know, the successive chancellors have used it basically as a milch cow, you know, the place to grab when everything else, all the coffers had run out, so grab some more taxation, just like this year's budget, for example. Same thing happened again. And they've had very little regard to the future, but perhaps, who knows, Alec Kemp's work will bring about a change of attitude. But I hope, you know, it'll help the process, which I think is happening anyway, where people in Scotland are finally waking up and saying, well, look, Westminster's had a turn for 40 years. Perhaps the people of Scotland should get a turn for the next 40.
You're listening to North Sound Energy Week.
On Tuesday, Westminster's Energy and Climate Change Committee gathered and weighed some damaging accusations at the coalition government. They accused them of scaring off investors with the £10 billion windfall tax imposed in the budget earlier this year. The committee called the Chancellor's scheme opportunistic and not sensible. The MPs claim it's left the UK with one of the most unstable tax regimes in the world for the industry. North East MP Sir Robert Smith is a member of the committee and spoke to our reporter Rebecca Curran after the meeting.
As part of our inquiry into security of energy supply, we looked at the consequences of the budget on investment in the North Sea. And it became clear to us that government had damaged investor confidence, which threatened jobs and maximising the oil and gas production.
Now, we've seen words, you know, like opportunistic and not sensible. I mean, can you go into depths of that?
Yes, clearly it's not sensible to surprise investors. We need lots of investment if we're going to get all the jobs that we should benefit from the North Sea. And investors, if the Chancellor's going to suddenly change the tax system, you'll get frightened off.
So would you, I mean, when we heard in the budget about this windfall tax, that was the overwhelming element, wasn't it? Was surprise and shock.
Yes, the government really shocked the industry because they'd been led to believe that there was no tax changes planned, and it's crucial to going forward for the government and industry to have a proper dialogue so there are no more shocks and we maximise the jobs and the benefit from our North Sea.
What fears have you kind of relayed in this report? You know, what do you fear is the worst case scenario? What's the worst that could happen?
The real damage is oil and gas gets left in the ground, and any oil and gas left in the ground means less jobs, no tax for the Chancellor, and less gas for British consumers.
And I understand that the committee heard evidence this morning about Britain becoming, you know, the most unstable oil and gas province in the world.
We'd certainly heard that it's become very unstable for investors in terms of the tax regime, and that's why it's so crucial that the meetings the Treasury are now having with the industry are built on a constructive basis so that there's no more shocks in the future.
And is that the top priority? That is what you want ministers to do now?
Crucial for ministers to really engage with the industry and reassure investors so we maximise the benefit from the North Sea. We can't get that oil and gas and get the benefit of it without encouraging the investors.
I mean, how do you think they're going to go about having a more sort of a more constructive relationship?
Well, they have at last started talking, and the industry has welcomed that engagement. So it's now crucial in the forthcoming budget to see benefits of that discussion so that investors get the confidence that we really want to get the best out of the North Sea. I mean, the report really reflects the concerns we heard and reflects that it's such a long-term major financial commitment to explore and produce from the North Sea that investors need to have the confidence that the government aren't going to shift the goalposts without warning.
And just finally, I mean, Chancellor Osborne's windfall tax, I mean, how much damage do you think that it's already done?
Well, the big projects, like the BP project, still going ahead, but it's the smaller projects that are the lifeblood of a mature province like the North Sea that are at risk. And now, by restoring confidence, should be able to rebuild the trust of the industry and maximise that investment.
On Wednesday, one of the longest-running rows in the industry began 2 days in front of the highest court in the UK. At the Supreme Court in London, unions were demanding 4 weeks paid holiday a year for offshore workers. It's a fight that's been rumbling on since 2003. At the moment, they're exempt because they go offshore for 2 weeks and then have 2 weeks off. Jake Malloy from the RMT union spoke to North Sound from outside court.
Well, it's the third or fourth stage now of what's been a long, drawn-out battle to try and secure paid leave for offshore workers. In the same way that all other workers are entitled to 4 weeks leave. We're in the Supreme Court, having come through two stages of tribunal, Employment Appeal Tribunal, and the highest court in Scotland, the Court of Session. I'm optimistic that we'll get the right result. Whether we get it here or whether it has to be referred to Europe is the question. I don't know that the Supreme Court will give us an interpretation given the number of different interpretations we've had through the legal system thus far. I mean, everybody seems to think that because offshore workers have 2 weeks off every month, they've got more than enough time for holidays. What the general public seems to be missing out on is that the offshore worker works the equivalent of a 42-hour week for 52 weeks a year. It's compacted into shifts, just the same way as it would be for someone working continental shifts, 4 days on, 4 days off, or for fire brigade workers who work similar, 4 days on, 4 days off. None of these other workers are being told that they have to take their holidays during a period that they wouldn't otherwise be working. What we want is the same ruling for offshore workers, that time off means exactly that, time away from work. The reality is the judges could at any time say, right, that's it, we're bringing the matter to a close and we're referring it to Europe. So we could be in here for 10 minutes, we could be in for 2 days, I don't know.
It could now be weeks or even months before a decision is made, or the matter could be deferred to the European Court of Human Rights. The week ended with another cause for debate surrounding Europe. The Energy Commissioner announced plans to bring in a raft of regulations already in place across much of Europe. The aim is to ensure the highest safety standards possible in the North Sea. But Oil and Gas UK say we already have the toughest rules in the world for drilling offshore. Aberdeen oil economist Professor Alec Kemp says current systems are fit for purpose.
Well, I'm actually very doubtful about the usefulness of the EU coming in with a safety and regulatory regime of its own for the North Sea oil and gas industry. We have developed over the years a well-designed system following the Piper Alpha disaster to deal with the safety issues. We've got an independent body, the Health and Safety Executive, which is quite prepared to take a tough line if necessary. The expertise is well developed both within the industry in the UK and indeed in Norway and within the Health and Safety Executive. So although clearly there are lessons to be learned from the Macondo well incident in the Gulf of Mexico, these lessons can be taken on board by our own Health and Safety Executive, by the Department of Energy, and by all the companies. And there's plenty of evidence that this has been done already. So to have another layer regulation from Brussels. It seems to be unnecessary and could actually just add complexity without adding effectiveness.
I mean, some critics have said, you know, to move to this blanket sort of EU regulation, it's moving over to people that are perhaps not as expert, you know, concerning these issues in the oil and gas industry.
Yes, and broadly speaking, I agree entirely with that. We have the companies themselves, which have had to deal with all these issues over the years. We've had the evolution of our regulatory framework, such that now the Health and Safety Executive, independent from the Department of Energy, is in charge of the safety regime. And we learned very hard lessons after Piper Alpha, but broadly speaking, these have been effective in terms of the type of regulatory mechanisms that are likely to be most effective. So the safety case, which was instituted following the recommendations of Lord Cullen, is the centerpiece on the safety side. And there seems to be general agreement that this is an effective and cost-effective way of dealing with the problem. And the Health and Safety Executive have certainly shown their independence, have been quite capable of intervening when necessary. And building on all that, and taking lessons, of course, from Macondo and any other incident, seems to me to be the way to go. And introducing yet another layer of bureaucracy with maybe rather different regulatory approach could just add to costs without adding to the effectiveness of the system.
Now, I mean, can you see anything in these new proposals that would be anything new, anything groundbreaking? I mean, we know that this year we've had the introduction of the Osprey, the cap. I mean, does it offer anything like that that we haven't already got?
Well, from what I've seen about the proposals, it's not at all clear that there would be anything which would add significantly to the effectiveness of the system, which is to minimise within reasonable cost the likelihood of safety incidents and spills on the environmental side. The measures have been taken since the Macondo incident, so there was quite a prompt response, and insurance schemes have been added, which were quickly put in place after that incident, and there are others in train. So I'm rather dubious that we need yet another layer of intervention, which could use different principles. So, I mean, our one is based now on the safety case approach, backed up by independent regulator on the safety side, the HSC, and there's no evidence to suggest that the HSC hasn't been independent and willing to intervene whenever necessary.
We know this is the same man, Gunter Oettinger, that proposed for the oil moratorium after the Deepwater Horizon. I mean, do you think this is another in a line of sort of sensational proposals that don't actually go very far or help much?
The kind of blanket idea of a moratorium seemed to me to be not very well thought through. It's like saying, well, we've got deaths on the roads, let's stop the use of motor cars. And, a blanket approach like that, rather than inspecting the consequences of different activities in different parts of the UKCS, seems to me to be the more cost-effective generally effective way in minimising incidents, whether on the safety side or on the environmental side.
And that's the Energy Week podcast. I'm Fiona Winchester.
This is the North Sound Energy Week podcast.